Hello and welcome to Gaming Quest episode 438. I'm your host, Mike Pragmata Apps, and with me as always,
proud spaceman father to an adorable robot daughter, David Bernie Fanboy Master.
And this is Smoking Joe Gamer. No longer Joey PP, now it's Joe Coho.
Oh, dreadful.
Truly dreadful. Over there. That is the worst time I've ever heard.
Let's go find a way inside.
I should probably turn down Pragmata, so we're not.
It's not getting, like, caught up in the mix.
Yeah. Two of us have been playing lots of Pragmata.
Yeah.
It's goddamn good. Capcom is having some kind of year and they're not even done.
Yeah, no, like, they've basically made, like, two Game of the Year contenders so far.
Yeah, I mean, some people might even put Monster Hunter Stories 3 up there.
Oh, yeah, I almost forgot that one.
I wouldn't quite put it that far up there, but it was very good, if you read my review. Just
yeah.
not quite Pokemon level, but it's getting very close. Oh, fuck!
Also, thank God, Pragmata got a review on RV Gamer, so we're allowed to talk to it without feeling bad.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know how that happened, but I'm not going to question it. I'm just going to roll.
Like, there is a lot of, like, potential build variety in there.
It's true.
Like, you can make a lot of, but like many Capcom action games, it's about, like, the interesting dynamic of resources. Like, you know, better not use all your shots of your kind of disposable, kind of not secondary weapons.
Mm. Yeah, I do enjoy how you don't have to, like, scrounge around or save up money to try and refill your ammo. You can kind of just go back and you're good.
Yeah, and, like, you know, tense fights are going to give you additional ones.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, it does mean that, like, there are going to be times where, like, you could use one, but maybe you shouldn't because there might be something stronger that you're going to want before you get your next return to the shelter.
Yeah, and I do love the frantic action of, oh, I've used up all my weapons, I'm going to run around and pick up whatever's there.
Yeah, like, what do I... I've used all of my preferences, what has the game left
yes.
for me?
What's really impressed me about the game is this whole concept of, oh, you have a hacking thing in the middle of a shooting game, is that's a very precarious balance to get right. I was thinking about this a lot while playing it, because the things you fight can't move so fast that, you know, you can't pay attention to the hacking at all. But they also can't move so slow and be, like, slow brain dead.
That it's not that you don't have to think. Right. That, like, it doesn't matter how quickly you complete the hack.
It doesn't, because then it feels like, it doesn't feel like there's any menace, and if you go too far the other way, it feels like everything's just going to kill you, and it's not fun.
Yeah, like, the thing that I've been thinking entirely as I've played it is that it's actually kind of the world ends with you.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I would say it's better, but yes, I can absolutely.
Like, it's a better
that.
Implementation.
Yeah.
Because it actually requires that you engage with both sides of the gameplay.
Yeah.
But it is kind of doing that same thing, where it's, like, reliant on the idea of, like, trying to engage different parts of your brain and force you to keep tabs of multiple things at once.
Yeah, because,
Yeah. Really cool. No other game, like, there are a lot of other shooters. None of them are doing what this is doing.
No. And I mean, that the hacking isn't even super simple either. It's not like you're just moving a thing through a maze or anything. You have to avoid certain warning nodes. You have to decide if you're going to use your special nodes in there.
Yeah, that's another resource
on the fly. Yeah.
And if, like, sometimes, like, if you decide you don't want to use one, that means that you are going to have to take a relatively circuitous path.
Yeah. Let's check it out. And there's also other thing, and that, of course, it adds more wrinkles as you go along. Like, there's a, you get the ability to auto-hack, which may sound stupid easy, but as you're hacking, you're building up this gauge that eventually lets you use, like, a super hack. And if you use the auto hack, uses that up. So you kind of have to make a decision of when you're going to use that, because
because the super hack is extremely powerful and a very good, like, I'm in a bad situation.
Yeah.
Like, emergency lever to pull. So losing that is difficult, but it is, like, it is a limited resource. You are not building up the super hack very often.
No. No, and I think that's
watching the fight I did just before we started.
that's another careful balancing act. Like the super hack, if that was available too often, that would not.
It would defang most of the major encounters.
Yeah,
you are going to have major encounters where you just don't have it.
Yeah.
Another thing I want to bring up is that, like, there's obviously the lovely dynamic between Hugh and Diana. Like, it's super cute. They do some interesting parallels about, like, the way that, like, and a lot of this comes through in Diana's performance. Both Hugh and Diana's vocal performances are fantastic, but her performance does a good job of, like, the dialogue is robotic, but it's expressed as in a very childlike fashion. That, like, sort of bridges the, like, metaphor gap. So you'll get things where she's, like, she's doing the robot thing where, like, Hugh is talking about, I remember early on there's a bit where Hugh talks about the warmth that humans have, and she does the literal robot thing where she's like, oh yeah, humans have blood in them and that makes them move, or humans are roughly around 36 degrees Celsius. And because of the way it's performed, it comes off as, like, child proudly repeating fact they learned.
Yes. It's kind of adorable.
Oh, yeah, no. Like, absolutely a wonderful dynamic. But another thing I want to bring up for the writing is, like, how much it's, like, a game for now in terms of what it's, like, thematic choices are.
Mm.
Like, one of the data pads you find, again, fairly early on in the first, like, major set piece area, the place you saw in previews where there's, like, a fucked up version of New York that's just been, like, the robots are kind of 3D printing a New York, and they don't really understand what that means or what that looks like. And so they've just, like, tons of, like, existing ads are, like, overlapping each other, and, like, cars are, like, halfway inside of walls and shit.
It's wild.
Yeah, it's a great set piece. It's very fun to navigate. But the thing I was going to bring up is that like, there's a bit where you find, like, a data pad where someone's talking about, like, oh yeah, I can have it just, like, 3D, you know, essentially 3D print anything I could ever want. I could live here forever.
Mm.
And just this idea, it kind of touches on, you know, there's obvious elements of generative AI commentary within the narrative, and it's sort of in that place. It feels like it's touching on this notion of, like, the ability to live and consume only the things that, like, bring immediate pleasure to the id. And the ability to ensconce yourself in this case, it's talking about the past, but just, like, the ability to ensconce yourself in
what you imagine perfection to be, to never like change or grow, to just let something else make it. It's fascinating, and you see elements of things like that touched on it. It feels like a very fit for 2026 video game.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you know, I'm only a few hours in, but it's, you know, again, Capcom going from strength to strength. This is a wonderful game. Do not let it slip by. And, you know, I've been playing Switch 2 handheld. It still looks and plays great. I don't, like, obviously it doesn't look as good as the PS5 version, but it still looks and plays great.
Yeah, it's definitely 60 frames per second. I don't think I've seen any dips.
It definitely dips. I've seen it dip.
Okay.
The VRR on the Switch 2 screen definitely helps it. And it's another to the credit of the implementation of DLSS into the in the Switch 2's like in RE Engine and in the Switch 2, that, like, because much like Resident Evil 9, if you looked at the internal resolution it's running at, I think that, like, the on a technical level, it's running at like 360p.
Wow.
And being upscaled to 1080p in a way that does not look bad, and in fact looks quite good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful game.
So what I could contribute here is just that I did play the Pragmata demo on Switch 2. I was pleasantly surprised with how good it looked, how well it ran, the reflections and all that. And again, yeah, as you said, it's a tribute to the RE engine. You know, RE9 was the same way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just a very well-optimized game engine. And yeah, the use of DLSS on Switch 2 is helpful. If I were to buy it, I'm sure I will at some point, I might just go with the PS5 version.
If you don't want to play portable, yeah. I understand.
And so, but no, but I will say, once again, like I say it all the time, like I've been very impressed with the Switch 2 so far. Like, Nintendo finally has a console that can really go toe-to-toe with the more expensive ones. And especially with recent price increases, I'm sure that the Switch 2 price tag is just looking even more attractive, and I'm just hoping more people buy the console and, you know, enjoy these games.
Yeah, it's been actually a pretty interesting week for just shooters in general. I'm still like weighing back and forth whether to grab Mouse PI for Hire.
It looks pretty wild.
Yeah, it looks like a weirdo game. I like weirdo games.
Yeah.
But yeah,
it's really definitely aping on Cuphead, and
yeah,
as much as I love the art style of that game, I fucking hate that game.
Somewhere game. Like a classic cartoon nerd is like screaming at you.
Yeah,
why?
That's the source material that both are drawing upon.
I know. I'm just, for people that might not be aware, I understand that that's all based on old cartoons. I know it's not really aping Cuphead. Please, no one yell at me.
all I can say is
I get you there first.
I finished Cuphead, and I don't know why I submitted myself to that torture, but I did beat it. And I never want to play it again. Because
it looks pretty. It looks really pretty. But yeah. It's, as a game, I hate it. It sucks.
Yeah, that's it.
I wouldn't say it sucks.
Okay, it doesn't suck. It's painful.
It's like playing Contra Hardcore.
Yeah. It's like playing Contra Boss Rush Mode is what it is. And
that's why I said Contra Hardcore.
Yeah, right. And I like the run and gun levels, even though they are still hard, but there's only like three of them the whole game. So I feel like all of that art design and music, all that awesome stuff they did was just wasted on a weird boss rush type game. Although you do find some secret stuff on the map, which gives it more of a Mario feel. Only when you're in the overworld, though, not in the actual game. And then trying to play it two-player, you can actually revive each other, but then I think there's more bullets and just other shit on the screen. So my brother and I tried to play co-op one day, and we're like, this is even worse than solo. Like, this sucks. So
it has only gotten harder for some reason.
Yeah. That's awful.
There is no joy allowed playing Cuphead, only pain.
I'm sorry, I'm playing Pragmata again.
Yeah, that's okay.
That's okay, so am I. Oh, Fireminer's here. Hello, Fireminer.
Hello. Hey, Fireminer. Pragmata.
Do you have questions about Pragmata, Fireminer?
We'll answer those questions.
Well, someone else will have to actually look at the questions.
Guess I've got to. I will bear the burden of the cross.
Well, I'd like to talk about what I've been playing, if that's all right, and I'll try to keep it.
And that's
brief.
All the time we have for this week.
Okay. I got it.
No, go ahead, Joe. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. So this is this might take a while, but I'm just going to tell you. Over the past week, I've just been playing PS3, and I've been having a ball with it, I'm going to be honest. It's been fun to revisit some games that I bought like 20 years ago or 15 years ago, whatever. So. Our co-host Wheels
might have been funny.
Yeah. So our co-host Wheels, he came over to hang out on Tuesday, and basically I sold him my PS3 years ago, and I found out he still had it and it still worked, and it was like, well, I want my little boy back. So he came over and brought it with him. I think I paid you what you paid me for it, so I think it balances out.
Probably. But it was enough to get me a new PS3 to replace that one. So now I've had like every model of the PS3.
Yeah, so this is a slim model. It's the second one that came out. And I installed a 720 gigabyte hard drive because you could do that on the PS3. That was a neat feature. You can put a solid state drive in there, but you really don't get much of a benefit from that. And those are expensive right now. So I'm not going to do that. And it's got a Prinny Squad sticker on it and a Naughty Dog sticker on it. And I don't know, it was special to me, had a lot of sentimental value. And I was like genuinely surprised when you said you still had it and it still worked. And it's like, well, I want it back. So,
I mean, of course, if yeah. I only wanted to keep one, am I going to keep the giant fat model or am I going to keep the one with the Prinny sticker on it?
Yeah, exactly.
No question.
No. So, I'm going to say a bunch of things about the PS3 because you might be thinking, like, gee, why on earth would you buy a PS3 in 2026? And the answer is because PC emulation of PS3 really isn't great. Half the games don't work. Some of them run worse than they do on original hardware, and that defeats the whole purpose. And Sony's official solution has always been the stupid cloud streaming, you know, the PlayStation Now, which got folded into PlayStation Plus Premium. So they want you to pay $18 a month to stream these games from the cloud, and you end up with lower resolution and visual artifacts, input lag, and all those other things. So Sony has been slowly trickling out PS1, PSP, PS2 games, but PS3 games still must be streamed. We don't know when or if they'll be downloadable, whether or not they'll implement real emulation on the PS5 itself. And even if they were to do that, they might still want to charge you the subscription fee, or they might still want to charge you $20 or $30 per game. So I thought, well, I'm just going to buy another PS3. There's some games I want to play. One of those games being Disgaea D2, which never got ported out. That game does work on the emulator. I tried to load up my post-game save file on PlayStation Plus, and it threw up an error because the DLC was missing, because you can't download any DLC that you bought on Plus Premium. So basically my post-game save file was not loadable. on PS5, and that upset me. So I jumped on Amazon, and I took a chance on an Amazon refurb copy of Disgaea D2. I paid $30. It's in mint condition. It's the original case with the artwork. The manual is in there. The disc is immaculate. No scratches or dirt or anything. I loaded it up today, and I was able to load that post-game save file. And I figured that, like, there's got to be a new game plus here because I want to play through the story again. And sure enough, there's this one NPC. He's very generic looking, but if you talk to him, he's like, "Hey, how'd you like to go back in time?" I'm like, "Yeah, okay, sure." And that's how you reset your story progress. But you don't lose any of your characters or levels or equipment, so I still have characters over level 1,000, just demolishing these level 1 enemies in the tutorial stages. I got to try to find the cheat shop so I can level up enemies and make it harder. I forget where they keep that, or maybe there's other things you lose when you start over and you have to get.
Probably have to unlock it and wherever it unlocks.
Yeah, but I was playing that today, and not the best Disgaea game, but it's pretty damn good. Yeah,
coming from someone who does not really like the original game.
Right.
Gameplay-wise, it's very fun. The story is not great.
Right. Gameplay-wise, it's absolutely on par with 3, 4, 5.
Yeah.
The story is weak. Although, of course, Flan is adorable. Now, when the game came out, I bought the nice hardcover strategy guide. I still have it. It came with a DLC code for Razbarrel from 3, so she's in there as a DLC character. There's a bunch of others too. There's a DLC called the Fuka and Desko Show. It's a little scenario you can play, and you unlock those two characters. And I love Desko, of course. I think I still have my soundtrack somewhere, so I'm like, you know, hey, it's great to have that back in my collection. It was good to play it some more today. So physical games are fine. You pop the disc in, you might have to download a small update. A lot of the multiplayer stuff isn't going to be working anymore in these games. The servers have been shut down. But I also retained my physical copy of Final Fantasy XIII-2 because I got the nice collector's edition with the nice packaging with the 4-disc soundtrack. I also bought the hardcover strategy guide for that. So that game, I had tried to play the PC version, and I played for a few hours, and then the next time I went to go load the save file, it told me it was corrupted. It made me start over. Oof. And then the game glitched during the opening fight, so I had to do that twice. And it's like, yeah, I don't trust this to, you know, maintain my save file for me. So, you know, it's good to be able to play that again. And also, I did buy 13 on PC, and there was a long period of time where it simply wouldn't launch. So I do have the Xbox 360 digital copy of that, which was X enhanced. So I'm currently playing 13 on the Series X with the upscaled resolution. And when I'm done with that, I'll jump right into 13.2. And so I'm looking forward to play those two games. And then I actually did buy 13.3 Lightning Returns. I bought that on Steam a long time ago, never played it. So we'll see how that runs, but then I may end up getting a new disc for that game. We'll see.
Oh, but do you have your digital copy of the original Final Fantasy 13?
Yeah, I have the Xbox 360 digital copy, and then I bought it on PC.
But there is no one on PS3.
Right, it never got a digital PS3 release. So,
which is wild to me.
But at least playing on Series X, it's 4K resolution, still 30 FPS, but it looks gorgeous, though. It does not look like a freaking 15-year-old game, let me tell you.
Art direction.
And then, so for some reason, the Xbox 360 digital version and the Microsoft Store or Windows Store version, no cross saves, and they have separate achievement sets. So it's like, okay, like, geez.
No, that's before all the, what the hell do they call it, Play Anywhere stuff?
Yes, exactly. And that never applied to Xbox 360 games anyways, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. Would have been nice if Halo 5 was Play Anywhere, huh? That would have been cool. That never got ported to PC. Yeah, so those are two games looking forward to playing again, and there's a lot of games I just forgot that I had. So here's what I'm going to tell you about the PS3. Now, First off, if you want to sign in to access the store, you can't just put in your username and password. You have to scan a QR code and go to Sony's website, and then they give you another code to put in. It's complicated, but it only takes a few minutes, assuming you remember what your PlayStation Network password even is. So then the store is incredibly slow, and the longer you're on there, the slower it gets, until eventually it crashes and sends you back to the main menu. When you're searching for games, some of them simply don't come up if they're like fully delisted. Some of them come up, but there's no link to buy or download. Some of them come up and will just say disc only. It's like, well, why is there a store entry for a game that didn't have a digital copy? I don't know. So you've got to go to your download list. Now, my download list has 2,000 items because it's every single thing you bought or downloaded on PS3, PSP, or Vita. It includes avatars and themes, soundtracks, DLC, whatever. Like, there's hundreds of Rock Band songs in my list.
It's a strictly gigantic reverse chronological list.
Yes, so it's newest to oldest.
It's not even newest to oldest. I've noticed this before. If you unsubscribed from PlayStation Plus and then resubscribed, all the PlayStation Plus stuff gets slapped on the top of the list.
Yeah.
So to get down to the actual stuff you purchased, you have to scroll through every single PlayStation Plus item in the list.
Yeah. So thankfully, they still honor those entitlements.
They don't know how to put them away.
Yeah. And the thing with the list is it's not searchable, it's not sortable, you can't change it. So, okay. So now on top of all of that, some games are two files. You have to download the demo and then download like an access key file. And they're not together sometimes, right? Depending on when you first downloaded the demo or how long you had it on your system before you went with the full purchase. So, yeah, sometimes you've got to find two different files. In the case of Marvel vs. Capcom 2, that game, I mean, now you can just get that as part of the new collection, and that's what you ought to do. But that game is fully delisted, so it will not come up when you search. And it had two different demos, as I discovered after I installed one of the demos, and it did not unlock the full game. I downloaded the wrong demo file, apparently. I don't know.
What the fuck?
Exactly. So, on top of all of that, the download speed is incredibly slow. I think it's a mixture of server throttling and also just very slow data transfer on the hard drive.
Just a bad OS.
Yes, I have. So I have a 500 megabit internet connection. I was on wireless. I'm like, why is this so slow? Let's plug in an Ethernet wire. Let's move it to the other side of the room here. And it's like, no, it's still only like 30 megabits. It's like, so it takes forever to download stuff. And then downloading and installing are two separate processes. So after your game downloads, you still have to install it. And a 6 gigabyte game takes about half an hour to install. And you can't do anything else while it's installing. And God help you if the system shuts off for whatever reason. Not that it would, but it tells you do not turn off the power. So this past week, that's what I've been doing. Like, basically, I queue up a bunch of downloads, and then I go do something else while I wait. Or I tell it to install a big file. What's good is that there are a lot of games that I forgot were cross-buy, and a lot of games I forgot that I got through the PlayStation Plus service, other games I bought and completely forgot about. So when I had gotten my Vita back last year, I had seen a bunch of games in the download list, and I'm like, oh, I didn't know I had a Vita copy of that game. Cool. I can just play it on here. So Sly Cooper Thieves in Time is cross-buy. I got it through PlayStation Plus. It's like 4 gigabytes on the Vita, and it runs fine. It's 30 FPS, but I mean, it's a Vita game. It's fine. I was enjoying playing it, but I always thought, wouldn't you rather just play this on PS3? And yeah, the PS3 version is like 13 gigabytes, took like over an hour to install. But it's 60 FPS. There's cross saves, so I didn't lose any progress. And now I just freed up 4 gigabytes on my 32 gigabyte hard drive on my Vita, and my PS3, of course, is a 720 gigabyte, so I'm not in any danger of running out of space. So now that I've complained about how tedious it can be, I'm going to talk about good things that I like. So the PS3 does support high-res audio. Unfortunately, it's picky about file formats.
Some time in the next couple minutes, because I just realized while I was playing Pragmata, we have a ton of questions.
We do. Okay. I will get through this as quickly as I can. Sorry. So, what the hell was I saying?
Audio.
Yes. So it does high-res audio, but MP3 files don't do high-res, and it can't read some of like my FLAC files, OGG files. You know, it can't read files that actually would run at that frequency, which I thought was odd. PS3 has media server support, so you can connect to your computer and look at your pictures. You've got songs, videos that you can download onto the PS3. It is a Blu-ray player, of course. You can put an audio disc in and rip it to the hard drive. So I always loved the fact that PS3 did computery things. I can see how some people might have been annoyed by that.
You used to be able to install Linux on there.
Yes.
Just like the PS2.
Yeah.
Could you do that on PS2?
Yes.
So I put in one of my Star Wars Blu-rays, and it looked gorgeous, and it was playing DTS HD Master Audio. Like, that's neat. So yeah, so there's some cool features there, and you still have themes, you still have avatars. You can download PS1, PSP, Vita games to back them up onto there and then transfer them to a PSP or Vita using USB wire, although that's probably going to be slower than just downloading directly from the Vita itself. And it's just been fun to revisit old games, little Big Planet 1 and 2, Infamous 1 and 2. I was playing Mod Nation Racers today. Oh, that was a neat racing game, I thought. I was playing some DuckTales Remastered. That's a neat game. I was playing a game called Turover, which I thought I remembered being good, and it's really not. It's this weird kind of physics simulator type game that's actually not fun at all. And apparently I made it to the final level like 10 years ago, never beat it because it's ridiculously hard. It can be beaten in 20 seconds if you do a really weird wall jump at the start of the level, but I couldn't get it to work. So I think I've taken up enough of your time talking about this, but that's really what I've been playing all this week. Thank you.
Hooray!
PS3.
Okay, just a moment. Well, less hurry for that, but... let's see.
Okay, some quick ones. Remember when I complained about Evercade releasing Banjo 1 and 2 on a device that didn't have a second analog stick? Did it even have a first? I didn't think it had a first one. It turns out they're about to debut a new device called Evercade Nexus, which has a second stick. They must be being well if they can do that. Yeah, I think they have realistic expectations about who they're selling to.
Did they just put out another model, or is it upcoming?
That's what he's referencing, that they're putting out another model.
Yeah, I almost bought one of those, but then I'm like, wait a minute, this is going to cost a fortune to buy all
you
these
really
got
to be committed to the platform for it to make sense.
And it's like, I already have like all of these ROMs on my computer. It's like, sorry, you know.
Yep. Let's see. Relatedly, well, not relatedly, but next one. Gmod recently announced that they're porting a bunch of mobile phone games like Xenosaga, Pied Piper, and the spinoff of Digital Devil Saga Avatar Tuner. Well, Java emulators have existed for a long time. Oh, boy, do I know, and they suck shit. I wonder what happened in the last 10 years for Gmod to be able to A, get the licenses, and B, overcome the technical hurdle. Docomo phones used a proprietary service of Java, proprietary version of Java called Dojar. Someone only recently worked on emulators for that. I think this is, like, I don't think this was ever a completely unsolvable problem. I think it was a lack of will to make it happen. And I think it's one of those situations where, like, someone within Gmode looked at what they owned, and the answer is that they own a shit ton of, like, those old phone games, so they might as well be exploiting those in some fashion. And thus, this ends up happening. Like I said, I don't think that there was ever, per se, like, a unique technical hurdle to making these old Docomo phone games happen. I think it really just came down to there wasn't considered to be a market viable reason to do it.
I forgot. I just want to say one last thing that I completely forgot about. The PS3 version of Daytona USA has not been delisted, and it is still $10. And I was playing it, and it was amazing.
Daytona.
Okay, popping down. So let me just put Wild Arms 4 onto PS Plus. It comes with the usual emulator stuff like save states and rollback. Wild Arms 4 is Wild Arms 4. I know people don't like its plot, but if Sony plans to put 5 in Crossfire, then I'm fine with it. FireMiner politely asked you to turn the volume down a little bit for the game. It's a touch loud.
Really? I can barely hear it all. That's my bad. Was that from what early on? Maybe not. I turned it down anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was gonna say I played the first Wild Arms. I never finished it.
I assure you, 4 does not resemble it in any fashion.
Yeah, and I don't know anything about 2 or 3 either.
2 and 3 are fairly traditional RPGs with fairly interesting settings. 4 marks like a point where the series like completely changes its gameplay style. It has weird platforming elements and a more like strategy RPG combat system.
Okay.
But yeah. Unfortunately, as like it completely removes any elements of like weird gunslinger Western look to it, so you kind of lose that.
That's disappointing.
Yeah, okay. 5 brings that back.
Yeah, because I like that one character in the first one. He reminded me of Indiana Jones.
You were probably thinking of Jack Vambrace, incredibly weird name.
But, yeah, he's got that little animal critter partner, and then he's in that like underground tomb kind of place. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you got the girl who is at the magic school, and okay.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, you've got Jack Van Buress, aka Jack Van Brace. You've got Cecilia something or other, I forget what the what her last name is. It's like she's the princess. It's the name of the fucking kingdom, I would imagine, but I'm blanking on what that kingdom's name was.
Yeah. Back in the day, I used to change all the characters' names in those games, so I called her Jenny.
Sure, why not?
I thought Can't I just, I might have just watched Forrest Gump when that happened. I don't know. Maybe.
My memory was correct. It's Cecilia Adelheid. And the by far funniest name, Rudy Roughknight.
Jeez. That's a little rough.
Yeah. Rough for tonight.
I would like to also point out that when the knight here is spelled like not like at night, like a knight of a kingdom.
Yeah,
I was Rudy Roughknight, who turns out to be a robot for some reason.
I bought the PS1 Classics version on PS3, a long time ago, and when it got added to PS5, Sony gave me a free copy, and the PS5 version does have rewind, save states, some visual options.
You would need those, but yeah.
Yeah, well. Whatever, but it's nice that I didn't have to pay for it again.
Yeah, no, that's nice. I'm just like, it's just always funny that those have to be standard to every re-release, even in an RPG where they just don't make a ton of sense.
No, and so it's my hope that at some point maybe Sony will do the same with PS3 games, let us actually buy them, download them, and say, oh, hey, you bought this digital. Here's a free copy. I don't know. But in the meantime, I am hesitant to buy digital PS3 games just in case they become unplayable in the near future.
I don't think they would be.
No.
I mean, they've had that store sitting up there this long. I think at worst they would just make it download only and not buyable.
Yeah. So if I ever get back to
the QR code thing with them trying to get around some sort of inherent security flaw.
Yeah.
Okay. That would make sense. So if I ever get back into Wild Arms and finish it, maybe I'll play 2 and 3 and then maybe someday I'll get around to 4. We'll see.
3, I think, is probably going to be most people's preferred one. It's my second favorite. I have the most fond nostalgia for 2. That one's harder to recommend, but I appreciate it. I'm very, I'm still excited for Armed Fantasia. Let us all consider the time where, the like creator of Wild Arms, like pitched a Wild Arms 6, and Sony said no, fuck off.
Wow.
There is one piece of news that we should probably cover since it's kind of been making the rounds today.
Okay.
So do we all remember Shuhei Yoshida?
Sounds
familiar. the guy from PlayStation?
Yeah, he was like the head of Sony Worldwide Studios for like 11 years.
Yeah, he was funny.
From like 2008 to 2019.
I think I know who you're talking about. Did he pass away?
Ooh, he made a podcast appearance.
Oh.
Where he talked a bit about why he suddenly wasn't head of Worldwide Studios after a point.
Okay, what happened?
So apparently everyone's favorite, Jim Ryan, known smart business decisions maker, described himself as essentially being fired. So like his job was basically, and like I'll crib from IGN here, his top job overseeing PlayStation's internal teams such as Naughty Dog, Sony Santa Monica, Sucker Punch, Guerrilla Games, and Insomniac. He was announced to be heading a PlayStation-backed indie developer initiative. For about 6 years there, he was kind of their indie liaison guy.
Okay.
And then, you know, he just appeared on a podcast a few days ago where he said that, like, Jim Ryan basically told him to, like, go do the indie thing or leave.
Yikes.
And he claimed that Ryan told him to do that because he had disagreed on Ryan over, quote, some ridiculous things. I helped Santa Monica to make God of War, Naughty Dog to make Uncharted and The Last of Us, and Sucker Punch to make the beautiful Ghost of Tsushima. Tsushima was one of the last games that I worked on as the president of Worldwide Studios, but in 2019, after 11 years leading first-party development, I was fired from the role. Jim Ryan wanted to remove me from first-party because I didn't listen to him. He asked me to do some ridiculous things, and I said no. Given what Jim Ryan would proceed to do with the brand, might have paid to listen to Yoshida on that one.
Yeah.
But yeah, because it just felt like we couldn't leave that one unremarked upon, as it's been kind of a big, deal in the news today. But yeah, like I won't say I'm super surprised. It didn't seem like when it was announced, it seemed like something where like, okay, well, no one says that when they're like. It, like, this is not the kind of career move someone makes when everything is going great for them. Like,
right.
Indie games are important, but going from head of first party to indie liaison is, like, it's not a promotion.
It's a demotion, yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah, so I just wanted to bring that one up.
Okay. Whatever happened to Sean Layden?
I don't remember.
Because he seemed like a cool guy. He wasn't the best public speaker, but
that
he
might
seemed
have had something to do with him,
right? Because he would get up on stage at like E3 and stuff, and the way he talked was like okay. But he seemed like a cool guy. He seemed like he was knowledgeable and enthusiastic about the games. So I liked him. I don't know, but hopefully he didn't do anything awful and get himself fired.
Okay, it looks like he disappeared from the company around the same time as Yoshida was demoted.
Okay.
At the time, it was even speculated that, like, Jim Ryan might have had something to do with that. His claims as of 2021, which is to say close enough to it that you probably wouldn't want to say, like, he was just like, oh, I was exhausted.
Okay.
But yeah, like, I don't believe that that wasn't true, but at the same time, I also would 100% believe it if, like, he were to come back and say, well, that wasn't the whole story.
Right.
Let's see. Okay. Jumping back into the questions. After having done finished with the Ninja Gaiden 4 DLC, there's a DLC? Damn, I've got to pay more attention. I decided to replay FF15. There's something to be said about how designing a game not for hack and slash fans meant that Square Enix had to dumb down FF15's combat system and made it rely so much on one button. But let's just say that 15 is turned into a pure character action game. How many people would have bought it, and how many RPG fans would it have lost? So, like, there's a bunch of, like, there's a whole philosophical soup going on with what happens to 15's combat system. In part because it's, like, there are three philosophies happening to it. The first version of it probably would have, like, I wouldn't have called it character action, but mostly just because, like, just based on the way it was described, just because it sounds more like they were making, like, it was the Kingdom Hearts 2 team that was supposed to be making that version of the game. And, like, I wouldn't normally describe Kingdom Hearts 2 as character action. I'm sure some people would. But that's splitting hairs. But, like, I think that that's a fairly mass appeal thing, but, like, ultimately the reason that, like, it changed the way that it did was that, like, when it turned into 15, while Nomura was still on the project, he had, like, a strong belief that Final Fantasy should be party-based, and so the combat was being in the process of being reworked to allow you to play as Noctis and switch control to Gladio, Prompto, and Ignis. And we don't know what that would have looked like or how long they would have had to make that decision. But I do end up wondering if, like, ultimately what they would have arrived at might have ended up looking more like a proto version of 7 Remakes style.
Mm-hmm. I would guess so.
And then ultimately, when Nomura leaves the project to work on 7 Remake and Kingdom Hearts 3, it turns into, like, Tabata, as a scale choice, cuts the idea of playing as other characters, determining that playing as that Noctis's ability to use all the weapons is sufficient. I think that ultimately, basically no version of it when it became FF15 would have had a combat system complex enough to put off a normal player. But, you know, like, seen that, like, what that counts as is going to be different for per person. But I, like I said, I don't think that they were ever going to go, like, hardcore character action. Like, I just don't think that was ever in the plans. And I think that there's a good reason for that. Like, so here's one of the tensions that you run into with something like, we'll use Devil May Cry as the example. Just because that's, like, archetypal character action. A character action game has to have additional vectors of difficulty that a normal RPG doesn't. Or, like, even a normal action game. So, like, you look at something like Devil May Cry, and, like, surviving can be hard, but by character action game standards, surviving in Devil May Cry is not that hard. you know, if you compare it to something like a lot of Platinums, like Metal Gear Rising or Ninja Gaiden, surviving's not that hard in a typical Devil May Cry encounter compared to those. But the grading mechanism is eternal to the genre because it's what forces you to consider what you're doing. It's an external force beyond enemy variety that forces you to consider how you're approaching combat. Because, like, Devil May Cry is essentially yelling at you every time you just do the same boring thing over and over. It has the grading mechanism jump into your face to tell you, well, you should be doing other things.
Mm-hmm.
And that turns away a lot of people. Like, just the notion of that immediately turns people away. It's frustrating to some people to be surviving and then be told that they're not doing good enough. And like, this is one of the problems you run into, is that when you don't have this, you get your FF16.
Right.
A game that has a lot of options for how to extend combos, but which doesn't really incentivize doing them. There's not really a lot of purpose to getting good at the combat because there just aren't enough vectors for it to punish you.
Yeah, and you're just going to keep spamming the most powerful attacks, right?
Well, you get into a rotation of, like, if it's a normal enemy, you do, like, quick attacks that will kill it in a couple of combos. If it's a bigger enemy that has a stagger gauge that's worth filling, then you make sure that the stagger gauge gets filled, and then you do a bunch of DPS dump. That's just kind of how that game ends up functioning. And, like, the fact that in normal play, it just doesn't have anything to dissuade you from doing that causes the game to get boring much faster than the theoretical depth of its combat system would imply.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I've never seen Mortal Shell in my life. Wheels just started streaming it. Holy hell, I hate how this man looks. This horrible naked man that he's playing as.
Don't worry, he doesn't stay as this. Thankfully.
But yeah. It's just you need additional vectors, and I think ultimately pure character action game FF15, like, obviously those can sell, although they probably sell a lot slower than FF15 does. Like, if you look at, like, Capcom earning reports, Devil May Cry 5 does good numbers every single year. Like, it just keeps selling. These games can sell well, but ultimately, you know, the audience is limited. You kind of, to make them interesting, to make them good, you have to make them less approachable. Because there's a significant amount of requirement to keep them interesting, they kind of have to be difficult by some vector, whether it's the introduction of concerns that are beyond just survive the encounter, or whether it's something different entirely, or whether it's just making the encounters hard to survive. But ultimately, most players will find it dull to use new attacks that don't appreciably benefit them more than just using the attacks they already know. I think it would have sold fine. It probably would have sold a few million units. I think 16 is kind of what it would have sold. Which is to say, it sold, you know, about 3-4 million units. And that's, you know, obviously not as good as the 10 million that it actually did. Okay, Dynasty Warriors is casual friendly because of how universal and simple to execute its combo system is, despite having such a large cast. That said, which hack and slash or RPG that you feel does it best at displaying their character's individuality through combat? For example, has Bayonetta done enough to differentiate Bayo and Jean? There's supposed to be a limited degree of differentiation between those two to begin with. But I would like this is a cheat because I love these characters dearly. It might be just the FF7 remake games. Like, the characters in those have deeply individual, like, combat designs. Like, all of them have different things that they should be doing if you're just playing as them, that are befitting of their designs. Like, they're kind of like a masterclass in what this kind of thing can look like, and you can only get away with it when you have this much fucking money to spend. Like, having 7 or more characters that all behave this differently is wild. Like, and I'm very excited to see how, say, Vincent is going to be differentiated from Barrett. But yeah, like, I think that might be the high watermark in terms of making sure that every character feels individual and distinct. And, like, there's differences of scale there. I mean, like, you know, FF7 Rebirth has, like, let's see, Cloud, Aerith, Tifa, Barrett, Red 13, Ketchy, Yuffie. Like, and Zack plays differently from Cloud. In the few sections where you play as him. But basically, it has those, it has that many, it has 8 characters, which for, like, a pure action game is a crazy number, but if you look at, like, a Dynasty Warriors game, that would be an unacceptably small number. Like, most Dynasty Warriors games will have, like, 30 or more as kind of a low estimate. Like, there are ones that are smaller, like Persona 5 Strikers, but they're very much the exception, not the rule. And so their degrees of differentiation are typically smaller. They kind of have to be. But yeah, I would say, like, the high watermark for, like, keeping every character feeling individually distinct for me would be Rebirth. But I think that, like, in typical character action games, like, you know, you do get very good ones, like Devil May Cry 5 Special Edition. Virgil feels different from V, feels different from Dante, feels different from Nero, even though they all share, like, certain elements of the vocabulary of design. We talked in regards to character action games and difficulty vectors. Basically boils down to how much can the enemy do when the enemy is hit, does that react strongly, how many mechanics can you exploit, and all the other things that make fighting games less accessible. Yeah, there's definitely elements of that. It's funny how there's a barrier of entry for fighting games because there are so many different interactions, so many things to keep track of, but then you remember visual novels and how it's niche too, despite having not a lot of interactions to speak of, too much game for novel readers, too little game for casual gamers. So the thing I would say that actually keeps fighting games niche, is everyone still here?
Yeah.
Am I still here? Okay. So the thing I would actually say keeps fighting games niche more than them being complex is that you're just going to lose a lot. Like, a lot.
Yeah.
And, like, there's a non-trivial amount of players who just will never have fun if they're losing a lot.
Like me.
Yeah, and it's just good to be aware of that in oneself. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's useful to be aware that is what's happening.
I think there's even some people that don't mind losing. Like, I don't mind losing, and I have gotten to the point sometimes in fighting games where it's too much.
Too much concentrated losing will make you miserable.
Yeah,
but it is one of those things that's like, I think that's... We see, like, the eternal debate of how do we make fighting games more accessible? And the answer is, like, you could make them 100% accessible. And it really wouldn't matter because a significant chunk of the player base would be like, well, I'm still getting stomped. I understand what's happening and I'm still getting stomped. And I think that ultimately is... A largely undiscussed problem with it is that, like, you kind of can't fix that other than to somehow find a way to push against player expectations, like find a way to make them enjoy, like still enjoy losing. And like that might be possible. There might be ways to do that, but you've got limited vectors. Again, when I think of like a game that allows you to still do interesting things while getting stomped, I'll bring it up time and time again. Titanfall had a really interesting situation that occurred when your team got stomped. Your team loses and your objective changes. So now you have an individual way of attempting to scrounge out something that feels like victory.
Yeah.
And the winning team suddenly has a new objective to try to take that away from you.
You can double lose.
Yes.
You can double lose, but more often you will lose win.
Yes.
Or at least feel like you could have.
Yeah. Because you got to get back to the ship before they blow it up.
Yeah, yeah. and to prevent them from blowing up the ship. So another thing I would say that makes fighting games uniquely have this issue is that there's not a lot of other things you can blame it on. You can't, like, you look at something like League of Legends or, you know, a MOBA in general. You have four other people on the team who you can 100% hate with all of your heart. They did this. They're the problem.
Yes.
There's no ability to spread the blame in a fighting game for why you lost. You can point at something like lag or eaten inputs or something like that, and sometimes they're even true, but they can't be true enough to make you not get pissed at the game. And in fact, they may piss you off more at the game. But like on some level, like a team-based game that takes longer, you can point at over and over, well, something else was at fault, so I can keep playing. I don't feel like I failed. The inability to like turn that loss into something that you can point at and say, someone else did that, not you didn't win. The inability to like point at someone and say, well, someone else is at fault for that, is ultimately like a huge psychological barrier to getting a lot of people to just keep playing fighting games until they can win. There's just a lot of things working against fighting games. Also, the matches are so short that like you can have essentially everything that happened in your working memory. A 40-minute like League of Legends game, you've forgotten at least some of the things that pissed you off by the time you start your next. There's just a lot of elements of human psychology that prevent people from sticking with fighting games.
I can tell you that I played a few matches of Street Fighter 4 online and got stomped and said, well, that's not for me. I thought it was hot shit because I could beat the computer on the highest difficulty, but then you go online and you can't make it out of the bottom tier. And similar thing.
I'm going
to briefly
interrupt you for a thing that Wheels may need to keep track of. Okay. Fireminer said, "I think you guys should raise your microphone volume. I'm having a bit of difficulty."
Yeah, I already fixed that. So the issue we had in Discord when we first signed on was also occurring on the RP Gamer stream. It was not happening on my stream. I double checked it, so we will have a good recording.
Yeah, we have a version of the audio that doesn't suck shit.
Yes.
Okay, that's good to know.
But that's what was going on. That's why he said before the game volume was too loud and I was confused.
Okay. So, what I was going to say is Street Fighter V, I played all the character stories. I did survival mode. And it was the same thing. It was like, okay, I feel like I've learned the game. And I got further with that one. I think I played over 100 online matches. I've never made it past Super Bronze. It was the same thing. I would beat M. Bison on the highest difficulty, and then I'd go online and get stomped. And to me, it wasn't so much like losing is one thing, but when they're teabagging you, when they're taunting you, when they're hustling you, like that's what annoys me. It's the way that people behave more so than the fact that they're just better than me. if someone's respectful and they beat me, then it's like, okay, yeah, hey, you beat me. And then typically when I lose, I don't want a rematch against that same person, you know, because then they're just going to beat me again.
Yeah, that's considered like fighting game rude.
Yeah, to not allow a rematch.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I don't know. They beat me once. I don't have to let them beat me twice, do I?
It's more about the idea of, like, seeing if you can, like, you know, 2 out of 3 is not, like, an unreasonable concept, but...
Yeah. Well, I think the issue with casual matches is you don't know who the hell you're getting put up against. Whereas at least with ranked, you're supposed to get someone of your same level, although I'm finding, again, that even the lowest tier human can still play better than the computer. You know, the computer does things that humans can't do, but humans do things that the computer was never programmed to do. So it's tricky. But where I'm going with this is that Street Fighter VI, I always played in classic controls, and I played a lot of matches against the computer, and I did World Tour mode. I played against you guys. And when I finally worked up the guts to go online, I did 10 placement matches with Ken and went straight to silver. It was like, oh, so that felt good. And I had definitely had some good matches there. And I do remember people saying that because of modern controls, they were finally able to get into it and enjoy it. And of course, you know, you have this elitist attitude amongst some of the hardcore players that, oh, well, you're cheating. Oh, you're only using modern controls. And it's like, well, modern controls actually reduce your outgoing damage, so
honestly the outgoing damage is not actually the problem for most characters, but modern controls are definitely like complaining about them as scrub material. But like the actual disadvantage you get with modern controls is that you actually lose a bunch of moves, and some characters, like, they don't care about that much about like their crouching light punch, but some of them are like absolutely fucked without it. So It's actually an interesting push-pull.
So there are people who said they never got into Street Fighter Online until they could play Modern. And I prided myself on playing Classic and making it to Silver Tier. And I was also going to say Guilty Gear Strive is also it's difficult to master, but it is easy to learn. There are some pretty simple combos you can do. That was another game where I actually won a few matches online and felt good about it. So my recommendation to anybody would be you might just have to find the right game, and there are some that are a little more approachable.
It's been the general trend to make things more approachable. Okay, so a quick one. This time last year, I asked about how long would PS4 and OG Switch still get new games. Trails into Daybreak 2 will be the first Falcom game in a long time to not have PS4 versions. Switch ports of Trails games haven't been the best because they were handled by Clouded Leopard instead of Falcom themselves. Given how well the Switch 2 is selling in Japan, I just have to ask again, how many developers are dropping support for the PS4 and OG Switch? I think it's really going to come down to the kind of developer you're looking at. AAA developers making AAA games have every reason to push to jump away from those and not have to deal with them. Like Falcom is in a slightly different position where, like, they're internally a relatively small company that doesn't make a whole ton of stuff, so like if they want to maintain control of their games, which they tend to do, they want to support as few platforms as possible and to make them as simple to work with as possible. Falcom never commits to any platform quickly, but I think that they're probably, like, as long as I would suspect that, like, through the end of the Sky remakes at the very least, and probably the next, like, mainline Trails game, and then maybe we'll probably see the Switch 1 versions start to go away. But, like, certain companies, like, it's very dependent upon what it is. Like, Mega Man Dual Override is going to be a PS4 and original Switch game in addition to all of the current platforms, and that comes out in 2027. It's really going to depend upon the needs of the game. I think a lot of indie developers will probably end up sticking... the smaller scale indie games, if you're making a 2D platformer, why would you not just make a Switch version? But if you're doing like something complex in 3D that has a lot of post-processing or whatever, then maybe you ditch that Switch 1 version because it's just too much of a pain in the ass to make work. Which I think has happened a number of times, actually. Like, we actually, earlier, I briefly brought up Mouse PI for Hire, which has, like, all of those, like, last-gen versions have kind of disappeared. Who knows when they'll, when they'll happen, if they'll happen. Like, you know, those kinds of things are, I think, going to continue to happen, where those versions start to disappear. But it's not really going to be an all at once thing. It's really going to be dependent on the needs of the projects kind of thing. Okay. In regards to the question where we went off on fighting games for 10 minutes, the results of the secondary, what about visual novels then? Why do they remain niche? Imagine if a book had a battery you had to keep track of, but like one that like would run out of batteries in like 3 hours. Like, I think that like there's a, like the actual problem that visual novels run into is that the kinds of stories they're telling are niche for various reasons, like the same way that genre fiction is niche. Like, they're inherently a high engagement form of storytelling in a world where we have seen more and more, like, a larger and larger swath of society more interested in low engagement storytelling. The rise of the horrendous phrase second screen entertainment. The mandates that allegedly exist within streamers that, like, someone needs to restate what's happening in the plot about once every 20 minutes so that people who are flipping through things on their phone can remember what's happening. Like, visual novels, for good and ill, are extremely high engagement. They are, you know, novel length, frequently many novel, like, frequently longer than a regular-ass novel. They have a certain degree of engagement that, like, will sometimes, like, cause you to get an ending you find unsatisfying and feel cheated about, and suddenly you have to jump back, and oftentimes there isn't, like, there are ways to, especially in a modern game, to, like, jump back to a place that will allow you to not have to, like, re-engage with material you've already read, but ultimately you are more likely to have to read something a second time than you are with a linear book. And once again, just like the types of stories being told are, you know, often like genre fiction. Like, I wouldn't say, like, you know, if a genre fiction novel sells like 50,000 copies, that's a pretty normal amount for it to sell. Like, that's a pretty successful piece of random genre fiction by a non-name writer. I would suspect that visual novels are not uniquely niche so much as, like, they sell consummate with the kinds of entertainment they're actually closest to, which is to say books. So that would be my immediate bias there. Okay, last time you talked about Scandal with SF6 Alex story mode, I brought up the similarity with Fire Emblem. The thing is that Shouzo Kaga has things he just really likes to put in games, expansive maps, enemy reinforcements, brainwashing, people doing horrible things because they're crazily in love. Can you identify the favorite beats of other Japanese game directors? I brought it up a few times. Once upon a time, I had, like, back when this existed, I had a co-host post that was sort of about how certain artists, like, eternally return to certain themes. One of my favorites, just to name, like, an obvious and unending one, is Suda51's just love of luchadors. Like, there's going to be a luchador in there, or at least a reference to them, somewhere in most Suda games. He just likes them. Just thinks they're neat. And, you know, why not? I agree with him. But, like, I was talking to a friend about, say, Kazushige Nojima, the writer of Final Fantasy VII, Final Fantasy X, a number of other Square games, because I had, you know, at my insistence, that same friend was playing Glory of Heracles 3. And if you play that, you see a number of the things that Nojima just likes, including in stories, things about recurrence and cycles, elements of, like, the notion of a hero with a kind of, like, amnesiac, semi-constructed personality. These things just sort of recur. There's, now that I think about it, there's actually also a random scene where, like, you as the player character of a 90s RPG need to walk around in a dress. Like, you know, just one of those things that's like, huh, that showed up in FF7 as well. But yeah, like, you'll find that in certain elements of thematics. One of the things that allows auteur theory to exist, the notion as we understand it now, the notion of, like, an enormous group of people worked together, but you can still identify the fingerprints of specific individuals and how they affected the direction of the production. Those ideas come from this. And, you know, like, I think that there are definitely ones that you can immediately pick out fairly quickly. And then some that are more specific, or specific to games, like you'll find, elements, like certain game designers that, like, it's more in the kinds of systems they create, like, you know, but I do think that you can usually find these with certain, like, high level production people because of the kinds of games they end up making, not necessarily because they made them themselves, but because they produce because of their roles in high level production, they put together teams that inevitably end up producing this kind of thing. If you think about it, a problem with the non-linear Castlevania is that Dracula's castle itself isn't that big. You follow the floor plan of an archetypal castle, so you've got to go out of your way to do things like symphonies, reverse castle, or portrait of ruins paintings. For a roguelike, the size of Dracula's castle actually fits. I guess that's one way why the Dead Cells DLC worked that well. I mean, like, Castlevania ultimately would just sort of write this into its lore in the same way that, like, the castle itself would change layouts. There's references to the idea that the castle itself is a creature of chaos at least one of that, like, era of games, to reference the idea that the castle can change. You can do other things, of course, as well. Four and Order of Ecclesia have multiple, like, Super Castlevania Four and Castlevania Order of Ecclesia have significant sections that are just outside of the castle. Similar to, like, Bloodlines or, you know, Rondo, like, all of them, like, will have significant amounts of areas outside of the castle, but you can also just do innovative things in terms of, like, interesting kinds of rooms for the castle to have. You have things like, very few of them, other than, like, four, have a treasure room, but the treasure room was kind of a cool one to have. But yeah, like, I think that, like, one of the things that I think about a lot is that, like, there can be a feeling that limitations of setting and scope are chafing, and they are kind of, but they also give, there's a lot of room to be creative when you are placed in a situation where something is constrained around you. And I think that, you know, creative constraints did produce interesting solutions in that case, as opposed to just having any given Belmont travel all over the world. You had things like, you know, Portrait of Ruins, like Portrait Choice. That was an interesting choice to make. Let's see. Okay. Wheels isn't asleep yet, right?
No, not yet. I'm getting there.
Okay, we don't want to... Yeah, you sound pretty tired. We might pop soon. Okay, quick ones. I recently watched a documentary about the Phantom Menace, and so much of the marketing and merchandise just had Maul's face on them. How many other times do you see the antagonist becoming the face of the property? FF7 and Sephiroth? He's definitely up there. I'm not sure if he's the face, but he is a face.
Bowser.
Yeah, similarly, you can just sort of put Bowser on things and people will know what it is.
Mm.
Like, he's not the face, but he is a face.
Mm-hmm.
Maul is interesting because his visual design was so striking that he did completely eclipse every other character in that film. But yeah, in that sense, Vader was similar. Like, you could look at a normal... you know, you could look at a normal 70s dude, or you could look at, like, Darth Vader or Darth Maul, and it's like, well, yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to think of other things where, like, the villain of the piece just is the visual shorthand.
Don't they do that for a lot of the Far Cry games?
Yes, usually since your character is basically never seen, the marketing is entirely the villain. Yeah. So, like,
especially the recent games, because they use big name actors for the villain.
Giancarlo Esposito.
Yeah, I remember that really starts with like 3 or 4.
Yeah.
Like, I think for 3 it was kind of an accident. He was just like the villain was just the most... well known, but by 4 they fully leaned into it. Like, the villain is the is kind of the centerpiece.
Yeah, at first I thought the Far Cry 4 villain was the same voice actor as Valva Torres from Disgaea 4, and I don't believe that he is. But I don't know if it's Troy Baker, though, either.
I'm seeing performance capture by Troy Baker. They probably wouldn't have made that casting decision now.
Maybe it was Troy Baker.
This guy.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure.
Far Cry 4. Yeah. So, okay. So my question that you're looking up now, is the voice actor of Valva Torres from Disgaea 4 the same voice actor as the villain in Far Cry 4?
Yeah, so Troy Baker portrayed the villain of Far Cry 4. Again, that's probably a casting choice you wouldn't make now. Yeah.
What did he do?
I'm saying it because, like, the villain of Far Cry 4 is an Asian man.
Yeah.
Oh, right, right. Okay. No, because for a second I'm like, did Troy Baker, like, get in trouble or say something stupid on Twitter? Okay.
Yeah, no, nothing in particular. No, Valva Torres was Matt Mercer.
Okay.
He's busy running D&D games now, I think.
Sardines!
Sorry.
See.
Sardines.
I actually like sardines.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever had them.
They're salty.
Let's see. One more title. Okay, one more question.
I was just gonna say on the whole Darth Maul thing, I think it's funny that character went from a big on that cover and then disappearing forever to being like a huge Star Wars character, and thanks to the tireless efforts of Dave Filoni and team.
I was gonna say, like, I was talking to a friend who's grown tired of the recent era of Star Wars, and I was just like, well, Filoni is the kind of person that, like, you know, it's what happens when a fan takes hold of a franchise. Like, you know, you're going to start with some mass appeal stuff that is definitely what fans want, and then you're going to get some of the peculiarities of, like, this particular fan is nuts about this thing.
Mm.
and Maul is definitely one of those things that's a little of both.
Yeah. It's a little much, but everyone seems to love Darth Maul still, so, because he is cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to sell people on Maul, because, like, people have wanted to love him since 1999, because, like, again, incredibly striking design. Yeah. And then, like, in the actual movie, he might as well not be there.
Essentially, like, yes.
Essentially, anything could have killed Qui-Gon.
Yes.
And you'd get to roughly the same place.
But he has very cool storylines in the Clone Wars show.
He had weird Marvelous. Spider legs.
And he has a more appropriate fight and death by Obi-Wan. Eventually.
The rematch.
Yes.
Loses 2-for-2.
Yes.
So there's a new Darth Maul show.
Yeah.
So that takes place after the Clone Wars or
before? After the Clone Wars. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, so Darth Maul dies officially towards like New Hope.
Okay.
Like, he goes to try and find Luke on, I don't think he knows, I don't remember how much he knows about Luke, but he goes to Tatooine and he confronts Obi-Wan, and at that point Obi-Wan is like Master Jedi and just like kills him very quickly.
Wow. We will have our revenge.
Yeah, but it is the culmination of, like, years of storyline. I'm very much underselling it. And obviously there's more storyline now because they're filling in more of his story. But as I've always said, Star Wars works better as TV shows. Because it's a big galaxy.
You're still going to see the Mandalorian and his Grogu.
Well, I mean, like, yeah.
That was good. I don't know.
I feel like a movie to end a show like that is fine. Like, I don't... The last trilogy sucked. And I'm saying that as someone who enjoys watching all those movies. But they're very stupid.
Yeah, they can be
stupid. Then they are. They're all dumb.
I really hated episode 9. That's all.
It is. Yeah, it's dumb, but it's extremely fun to watch. And people love Last Jedi, and it's also very stupid. And I love Force Awakens, and it is also very stupid.
Okay.
It's okay to like dumb entertainment. I think more people need to accept that some of the entertainment is just dumb, and that's fine because it's fun to watch. Like,
yeah,
it's okay.
I don't like Boba Fett at all.
It's fine.
After his show, I don't think anyone does.
No, I didn't finish his show because like this.
I like the episodes of his show that were actually episodes of The Mandalorian.
Yeah,
yeah, that's basically everyone.
Yeah.
So
okay,
I want to tell you guys something funny real quick. I'm sitting here, and all of a sudden, I'm hearing this music. I didn't think anything of it. I'm like, "Where is that coming from?" And I look over, my Steam Deck is on, and it's playing Chrono Trigger.
That's weird.
And I'm like, maybe I was playing it, and I put it into sleep mode and didn't realize it. I don't know, but it was just very odd. And I'm like, well, at least it picked a good game to scare the crap out of me with.
Oh, my God. That reminds me of an anecdote from today.
Okay.
So normally you see pickup trucks, and they have very obnoxious bumper stickers. I'll leave it at that.
Yes.
But I was picking up my son today, and there was this pickup truck in front of me, and it's like, okay, it's got like the typical 80s stickers, like Thundercats, Back to the Future, Goonies, I think.
Cool.
And next to some video game stickers like Chrono Trigger, I think one may have been Earthbound.
Wow.
I forget what the other one was, and I was just like, this seems very out of place. I don't get this. I'm very confused. Can you strap a gun on the back of your truck or something so I'm less confused, please? that's all. I think that's the only time I've ever seen a Chrono Trigger bumper sticker. Just like the C that's clearly from Chrono Trigger. Yeah, that's all. Carry on. Carry on my wayward son.
Okay. I'm going to hit one more and then probably call it quits. People like to talk about how the PSP and Vita got new visual novels long after their heydays had gone. Thing is, the visual novel makers are slow to jump onto new platforms, like Koei's last PSP visual novel was released in 2017, and it was a prestige title, a remake of Neo Angelique. Like, it just sort of makes sense. You've got the technology in place. Like, the generation of words is a relatively low-cost generation of art assets is low compared to everything else in the industry. And you aren't terribly benefiting from the power of a new platform in most cases. So you only move on when it's clear that the audience has left to go to another platform. There's just no reason to do it any other time. I think that's just a nature of the beast. The big spend for a visual novel is getting all the technology in place on a new platform. So ride that into the sunset. Let's see. Yeah, I think we'll call it for the night. Oh, good lord, there's so many of these. Sorry, Fireminer. We'll keep these in your back pocket for next time. Okay. Since Gaijin is not here, I'm going to attempt the strongest plug I can manage. Okay.
Buy my book.
Okay. So, if you want fantasy that is, young adult aimed but enjoyable for the whole family, if you enjoy the social dynamics that come with tabletop role-playing game sessions, if you enjoy the concept of someone having to write by the seat of their pants because some of the things that are happening were literally done via dice roll and thus had to be written around, you should check out Princesses of the Pizza Parlor, now available in terrifyingly War and Peace levels if you were to read the whole series, but any given individual story is relatively bite-sized. These are available on Amazon in like print-on-demand dead tree format, in Kindle format, or you can go Kindle Unlimited and read them that way. This is, if you are in the actual play format style, this is a good literary simulacrum of such that has a more constructed narrative. You might enjoy that. You can, if you're more of the culture and history sort, you may find yourself drawn to Tanuki as a Teapot and other Japanese folktales, which has retellings of a number of Japanese folktales, some of which don't really have any other extant English versions. So if you want to get a little culture in your life, that could be a good choice. That is also available in digital undead tree formats. If you want something that's taking a spin on the idea of like putting a little bit of video game into your literature, you can try the Litroidvania Vanglorious Long is the Night. If you're terrified by that description, that makes two of us, but you probably should try to figure out what it means, because you won't find another one out there. These are all available by going to Amazon looking for author Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu. And you will find these all grouped together. There is also the more for adults romanticy works under the name Michael Spearwater. Those would include things like A Wager for Wanderlust and The Sin of Tantalus. I believe those are both out as of this moment. I can speak less as to their content other than that they are more aimed at adults, and I will leave it at that. But those options are there. They are available on Kindle. So look out. Find them if you dare. But otherwise, I think that wraps it up for book plugging. Joe, where can we find you?
Okay, you can still find me on the rpgamer.com Twitch channel, which you might be watching right now. I still do. I do live streams Tuesday and Thursday nights from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Eastern Time. Still playing East and Proud Nordics, making significant progress from playing, you know, 4 hours a week or more. So that's been fun. And then I do have a YouTube channel under Smoke and Joe Gamer, and I put up two new videos recently. Well, one was a short clip, one was a longer video where I just talk about trophies from the PlayStation and stuff. So those are on there. And I might be doing my annual Metroidvania event. So, you know, just check out YouTube for Metroidvania content. And then you can follow me on Blue Sky and Instagram, also under Smoke and Joe Gamer. And you can join the RP Gamer Discord server. There's a good community, and you can chat with us there. And that's also where you can post questions under the podcast tab in Discord RP Gamer. So you can join. Just there are rules to follow, and we just try to have fun and be respectful and all that.
The rules are mostly don't be a douche.
Yeah. Don't be an AI bot either. Not that AI bots will listen to me.
I don't think anything that could listen to this will be will be heeding that. But just a quick rundown of where you can catch us. If you catch us when we're streaming, usually around 8 p.m. Pacific to through however long. We feel like that would be 11 p.m. Eastern for U.S. For North American listeners. That's when we record on Mondays on the twitch.tv/RPGamer channel and the twitch.tv/AsWheels channels. Thankfully, FireMiner always manages to keep us loaded with questions, but if anyone else wants to jump in, we are always happy to listen. As for our other endeavors, we have Shenanigans. That's on Sundays at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern on twitch.tv/AskWheels. If you I'm more tired than I realized. Let's see what the other thing I was going to pull. And I had things to plug. Damn it. You can, of course, ask us questions in the RP Gamer Discord in the podcast section, and you can ask us questions in the comments. Thanks once again to FireMiner for keeping tabs on the comments for us, which saves me some time in the beginning of an episode. Otherwise, I think that about wraps it up for us. So see you, Space Cowboys.
See you.
See ya.